is a former lawyer, former politician, and former cabinet minister in the social credit government of Bill Bennett. He served in the portfolios of consumer and corporate affairs, health, and the environment, as well as responsibility for constitutional affairs. For nearly 25 years now, he's been a force to be reckoned with on radio, first at CJOR, and then for 19 years at CKNW, where for 15 of those years he was the host of their number one talk show. Now, the Rafe Mayer Show can be heard weekday mornings on CKBD 600 AM. Last year, he was honored with the Bruce Hutcheson Lifetime Achievement Award from the Jack Webster Foundation. His latest book, his fifth, from Harbor Publishing, Rafe, A Memoir, has just been published. It retails for $34.95. Welcome to the commentary.ca, Rafe Mayer. Good morning, Mr. Mayer.
Hi, how are you, Joe?
Pretty good, thanks. And yourself?
Very good.
I've read the book, and, well, I've read it for a couple of weeks now since Harbor sent us the galley. How is this book different from your previous books, Canada's Anyone Listening and Rants, Raves, and Recollections, and its sequel?
Well, there are a few similarities, I suppose, in the sense that I talk about some of the same things, but generally speaking, I think it, A, represents a sort of an advance of my thinking on a number of things, but the most important thing is that it's much different from the others in that it talks about the things that Tex Enemark and I did in consumer and corporate affairs that had never been talked about before. The bringing of the national banks to heel and forcing them to obey BC law is one of them. The effectively getting rid of beer parlors and getting hotel pubs is another. But I think perhaps the most important one was the establishment of the cottage wine industry, which has now become so successful in the Okanagan.
I took a course in history, I think it was at UBC or Langara, I can't remember, a couple years ago, and the instructor spent about a day talking about the social value of beer parlors, and it was under your watch, was it, that you eliminated beer parlors?
Yeah, we did it in kind of a strange way. The beer parlors were saying they couldn't make any money just selling beer, especially when there was a beer strike, and in 1978, I think it was, we had the second strike in 2 years, and they were screaming to have hard liquor, and at that point, it doesn't sound like much now, but in those days, that was politically undoable, just simply would not fly. So what we did, making a long story short, we offered them a new license. They would have to reduce their beer parlors. Most of them were in the 300-400 range, some of them even higher than that. They'd have to reduce the size down to 125, as there is in a neighborhood pub. They'd have to put in decent surroundings. We didn't expect the same standards, for example, in clean as we would in Vancouver. But they had to put in, you know, nice kind of digs. Having done that, we'd allow them to sell hard liquor, you know, whatever other liquors that can be sold. The first reaction from the big ones was that we were blackmailing them, and we simply said, no, you can take your pick. You can go on and fight the strike with your own way if you want to, or you can serve hard liquor if you come along this way. And at the end of the day, almost everybody did, and it was a terrific boon for the small hotels and the smaller centers in B.C. that were having trouble making it with the beer parlor.
Now, you mentioned the cottage wine industry, and I guess this is sort of like the Kelowna wines that are now world-renowned. Prior to your time in consumer and corporate affairs, there was no wine industry at all in British Columbia?
Oh yes, there was. We had the Plunk. You got to be careful with Kelowna wines because with a C, that's the name of a large wine company that at that time, it may still be, was owned by Standard Brands. And there were several varieties of Plunk that came out. Usually you saw them at Christmas time in huge jugs of Bon White or Bon Red, something like that. But there was no real attempt to bring out quality wines, to have the kind of wines that would mark the Okanagan as a place where good wines came from. And it's a long story, and I don't want to tell the whole thing or nobody will read the book, but at the end of the day, Tex Enemark and myself, along with the Deputy Minister of Agriculture and so on, worked out a system whereby small people with this, well, not small people, small holdings could put together a winery. And, of course, this was dumped on by the big wineries. They said everybody's going to get blind in the morning and all that sort of stuff, which is absolute nonsense. We were convinced by all of the evidence that we got around the world that the Okanagan was a very, very good place to grow grapes for white wine and might, if properly done, be good for red wine. And so we did a lot of things. We gave them a break on taxes. Matter of fact, we took no taxes at all for a while, gave them prominence in the liquor stores and so on, and encouraged them in many ways. And it has become a huge runaway success. And the only problem we thought we had with this was with the Premier, Bill Bennett, because, he came from the Okanagan. His father was a shareholder in Capozzi's, Kelowna Wines, and so on. And to his eternal credit, the premier asked only one question: are you going to create a license that people will be able to flog the next day? We were able to assure him that wouldn't be possible, because it would take probably 5, 7, maybe even 10 years to make one of these things profitable. And he said, go ahead with it. And so thus was born the fantastic wine industry we now have in South Central British Columbia.
You mentioned Bill Bennett there. I've always been fascinated by your reminiscences of him on your program. What was he like to work for as a minister? And was his political work, was that trying to get away? How much of that was trying to get away from his father's legacy?
I don't think, to answer the last question first, I don't think any of it was. Bill was very much his own man. As a matter of fact, when we came into the cabinet room the first time, all green as grass, and the deputy provincial secretary told Bennett that under his dad, the attorney general always sat on his right and the provincial secretary on his left, Bennett said the attorney general was sat on my left and the provincial secretary sat on my right, thus peeing on a couple of trees. And right off the bat, we knew he was definitely his own guy. To answer the first question, it was a gradual thing. I think most of us, particularly the newcomers, were a little scared of him. He was a real tough hombre. There's no question about that. We didn't know how he was going to react to what we did. But it very quickly became clear, I would say, in the first 6 or 7 or 8 months, that Bennett wanted you to run your own portfolio. He wanted you to be a minister in every sense of that word. He wanted, of course, the right to privately let you have it if you made a mistake, but he never did it publicly, never. Never backdoored you. And it got to the point, frankly, Joe, by the time a couple of years were up, I think I can safely say that every one of us would have crawled on our hands and knees for a mile over broken glass for the guy. He was that kind of a leader. He inspired confidence, and he led well, and I think all of us were delighted to have him.
Do you think that he'll go down in the history of British Columbia as one of our better premiers, do you think, alongside his father?
I think so. Already a book has been written, I forget the author's name offhand, by a man who worked for the province for a long time, and I think he ranks Bill Bennett as number 5. It's a tragedy that his reputation was besmirched by the Doman Holdings thing. I think I can say this without contradiction, that wasn't Bill's doing. That was his brother's, and that was Doman's doing. But Bill showed the kind of loyalty he always showed, as a characteristic, by going along with them. He didn't quit on them until finally they went to the Supreme Court of Canada for the umpteenth time, and he had enough. But I think he will definitely rank as a first-class premier. You got to remember that W.A.C. Bennett, great premier that he was, had glorious times to work in. The times from 1952 to 72 were excellent economic times. When Bill came in, it was quite different. There were a lot of problems, there were recessions and so on, and I think that will mean that Bill, for much different reasons, will rank right up alongside his father.
Let's bridge into current affairs. First of all, the Citizens Assembly, you talked about that for an hour today on your program, and it was quite fascinating. Are you happy with what the Citizens Assembly has recommended?
Well, it's early days right now, but my first reaction was, oh, no, I thought they were going to go mixed PR, the system that they have in New Zealand and Germany. But as I thought about it, and certainly as I talked about it with Gordon Gibson and Ted McWinney today, I've come to the conclusion that it's an excellent result. It doesn't foreclose future reform if people don't like the way it is. It does, however, offer an alternative to the present system, which is infinitely better. And as you will know, Joe, I've often said, too often we make the perfect enemy of improvement. And this is such an improvement over the present system that it will not be perfect, there'll be a lot of people won't like it, etc. But it'll, as I say, be a hell of an improvement, and it'll be a launching pad for people like Adrian Carr, who reacted very stupidly to it, I think, to work for reform of the system. So all in all, I'm very pleased, and I'm going to do what I can to encourage people to support it next May.
In your book, Rafe, a Memoir, you talk about Gordon Campbell, and it's perhaps too soon to assess his record and assess his legacy, but that won't stop me from asking you what you think about it. You pillory his environmental record and his government's environmental record, but you also consider the Citizens Assembly, the forming of that as statesmanship.
I think that was an act of great political courage. He had been prodded by a lot of people, myself included, to do something like that. But this is the first person I've known in the Western world, I suppose that's going too far, but who has put in place, put in operation a commission that could recommend a method of voting that wouldn't allow a Gordon Campbell with a majority to get in very easily. So I give him full marks for that. His record on the environment has been absolutely appalling. It's just enough to make one ill, and as a person who tends to be center and slightly right, I suppose, it makes me wonder what the hell to do in the next election, because for me, the environment transcends all other things. You can always fix up Medicare, fix up education, you may do some damage in the meantime, but it's mostly fixable. If you butter up the environment, that's gone forever.
What's your reaction then to people that compare him to Bill Bennett? I suppose for you that comparison is not apt.
It's not apt at all. I don't think there is any real comparison, except that Bennett looked like he was tough and looked like what he wanted got done. Gordon does the same thing, the difference being what Bennett wanted to get done made some sense and it didn't hurt a lot of people. A lot of people have to look back at his era and seen the social reforms that took place, the statutes that came in. Just in consumer and corporate affairs, for example, I passed 22 bills in 2 years, all of which improved the lot of the consumer. And that was a hallmark of Bennett's administration, a lot of those things. Because there's always been this business, always a government of right-wing car dealers, one line, and that's the end of the matter. People just haven't examined what he did, and I think in time, when they do, they're going to find that he really put into place some he made mistakes. Brick was one of them, but he put into place some good policies. Campbell, on the other hand, may look like Bennett and his sort of aggressiveness and tough talk and so on, but when you look at the record of what he has done and the record of what he hasn't done, I think it's not possible even to put them in the same sense, maybe not even in the same book.
Now, you said last week that on your show that Bennett didn't do enough about succession. Do you think Gordon Campbell has done enough within the BC Liberal Party? Should he no longer be its leader?
I don't know whether he has or not. That's a very difficult question to answer. And when I'm asked about Bennett, and I say, no, he didn't do much to ensure a succession that was going to be successful, I often ask myself, too, but what could he have done? If Andrew Zamm was that popular with the party, I don't know that if Bill had anointed anybody, Grace McCarthy or anybody else, that it would have stopped Andrew Zamm. So it's very hard to know, and since Campbell is a long way from wanting to give up the reins of power, although Bennett, at the same age, gave up a very few years later. But at this sitting, I can't see Campbell giving up the reins. And secondly, I think that, strangely enough, because the Liberal Party has got so many people that are prominent in federal politics and so on, there are names like Christy Clark and Gary
Collins,
and so on, that have sort of established an independent sort of position outside of the provincial party. In the Social Credit Party in those days, most of the members, one or two exceptions, they were known only as SoCred, so they didn't have a basis outside of the party. But it's a hard question to answer. I don't know whether you really can ensure succession, but it's sure a pity that Bill Bennett didn't if he could have.
We're talking with the broadcaster Rafe Mayer and the author of the new book, Rafe, a memoir, 3495, from Harbor Publishing. One of the things that I came to know you growing up was your opposition to Charlottetown. I want to ask you about the significance of that, and why do you think people like Bud and Monica Smith, whom you write about in your book, why do you think regular people like them stood up against the Canadian establishment so?
Well, I think it's frankly because the Canadian establishment has bullied them, has screwed them monetarily, has simply done things that run contrary to the grain of ordinary people like Bud and Monica Smith, who, as you know, I consider to be heroes for what they did. The Canadian establishment is just so out of touch with people in British Columbia, and I don't count us, as you know, as part of the West. We're an entity unto ourselves. So out of touch that I think that the thought of giving the central Canadian establishment even further hammerlock on running things and perpetuating their stranglehold on the affairs of Canada, it just came through loud and clear. And the longer the campaign went, and it wasn't very long, the more clear it became. And in fact, when some of the higher purpose persons, as Denny Boyd calls them, from Toronto, would say they're on the yes side, people... I'm just trying to think of someone. Pierre Burton is one that comes to mind, and several others. I used to say, well, there's another 1,000 votes for the no side, because people saw those people as just being Toronto and seeing the country as being simply an Upper Canada, Lower Canada debate. And as you know, that's not how British Columbians view Canada. British Columbians are very loyal Canadians, but they see the country differently than people in Toronto do. And they saw the Charlottetown Accord quite correctly as an effort to etch in stone for all time central Canadian hegemony over the country.
The chapter, we'll move into the radio part of your book and your career. Now, the chapter where you deal with your ouster from CKNW is sparse. Why?
Well, I signed a release in order to get the money, which said that I couldn't talk about the reasons that led up to the dismissal. I can tell you this, that those reasons were part of a press release that I released 2 days before the end came, and they're available. And I think I would probably be breaking my agreement if I were to make it public again, but it's out there, and it has been out there. The other thing was really, Joseph, while I think I was very, very badly done by CKNW, I think it was a horrid thing to do to somebody who had spent so much time there. In fact, I was very relieved because the last year or so had been really a torment for both my wife Wendy and me. And B, I just did not want to leave on a bad note. I wouldn't have minded having a shouting match with the manager, but that would mean I'd get into a shouting match with all the people that were still there, and they were all friends of mine, and I just didn't want that. I wanted to go into my new career on the high side, and I think I did. But that was basically the reason. First of all, as I say, I simply couldn't have done so without losing the money that I got for my departure. I suppose that's a little cowardly. I suppose I should have just said, to hell with you, I'm going to say it, and I'll sue you. But, you know, if you get to my stage in life and you look at a year's income, which was at stake, and you say to yourself, I'm not going to get that because I'm going to be high and mighty and sue these bastards, and it's going to be 3 or 4 years before it comes to a conclusion, I'm going to be in my deathbed by that time, I think it's pretty easy to understand why I just said, all right, I'll take the money and run.
Do you miss CKNW at all, or...?
I missed the old CKNW, Joe, when the Wick people were there, when Frank Griffiths was still alive, and you knew that absolute free speech would be the hallmark of the station as long as he or his influence was still there. I miss that part. I sure as hell don't miss the part which happened after Corus took over. Corus actually took over legally a year or two before they became, to me, a pain in the ass. But in the last couple of years I was there, last year and a half, 2 years, it was almost unbearable, and the mood of the place was so bad, the morale of the place had gone, it just was no fun. But if you could take me back to 1992, 3, 4, 5, or even before that, I loved it, and that part I miss. Although I've got absolute free speech here, I can do as I wish here.
Well, let's talk about the new show. Obviously, listening to it over the last year or so, I've noticed that your political thinking has become more progressive, if that's a correct observation, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. Is Sherelle Tobin an influence because she is known to be left-wing, or left of center?
Well, she'd be surprised to hear you say that she's left of center, but she probably is a little bit, and I am too. You know, Sherelle has been an influence for the better on my broadcasting for a long time. But I think I've got to take the blame or whatever it is for the way I think myself. I don't think I can pass that on to anybody else. When I was in government, a lot of my colleagues called me Red Rafe because I kept bringing in consumer legislation. You've got to remember, I brought in a Motor Dealers Licensing Act in a caucus with 6 car dealers in it. You know, so and I was the person that negotiated the saving of the Skagit River against the wishes of my caucus that wanted to turn it into a big lake full of jet skiers. So, you know, I think I've always felt that way, but what really has changed me more than anything else in the last couple of years is, first of all, I've seen what globalization has done to a lot of people. I've seen what NAFTA's done to a lot of people. I think those people should be helped. But secondly, I recognize that you can't change globalization. You're not going to change the trade agreements. They're there. There's no sense standing up and screaming that they've got to go because they're not going to. So I have become, I guess, what I call a 21st century socialist in the sense that I recognize these problems. I recognize the dictatorship of the corporation in our society, and I want to recognize it but do something about it, try to make it better. That's a lot different, I think, than trying to abolish things that are unabolishable.
So your 21st century socialism, is that different than that championed by organized labor, the NDP, or people of the left generally?
Oh, I think it's very much different. I suppose Ken Giorgetti has shown a little bit of common sense in saying that the free trade agreement hasn't been all bad, but most of them are still beating their head against the wall. I remember going to the leadership convention that Ujjal Dosanjh was elected at a few years ago, and they were singing the Ballad of Joe Hill and all that sort of crap. The people that were running for leadership were trying to out-left each other. You would have thought that Gordon Wilson had grown up in a coal mine town in Wales. And the whole party is just so far back in its thinking. If it had done, if it did something like the Labour Party in Britain had done, I think it would be a different story. Maybe I can answer your question by saying this. If a British-style Labour Party existed in British Columbia, Canada, I would probably support it. But to support the people that are running the NDP now, no, I wouldn't. It's just, they're just out of step with the times.
One of the interesting things in reading your book that I found quite actually humorous was that despite your championing of the Pacific salmon, you don't like eating fish at all.
Well, no, I don't. The exception I make is I used to like fresh grills or fresh trout or first thing in the morning if somebody made sure there were no bones. But no, I don't really care to eat fish. I love shellfish, but never cared to eat salmon particularly.
Your crusade against farmed salmon, you lamented last week that it seemed like a losing battle. Is it, or do you have hope that you can overcome this government's plans and this government's agenda?
Well, I think I also said at that same time, I thought that the Kamano completion project was dead, too. At least I thought my part of it was dead. I thought it was going to go ahead in mid-fight. And I turned out to be wrong. It was stuck. I think probably when Churchill quoted Harry Lauder, it sort of sums it up for me. You keep right on till the end of the road. If you feel that you're right, you just keep on bashing, and you have to hope that other people see it your way. And I think it's an issue that will not go away. I don't think we've lost it yet at all. Certainly it's not looking good from the government's point of view. But, you know, Joe, I'd ask you this. How many decent restaurants in Vancouver can you get farmed salmon at? And the answer is damn few. And I think we're making some impact there. So we just have to hope, but the fight goes on.
Let's talk about personal things, and you discuss this in the book as well. So you talk about being a performer, doing your job as a performance, I suppose. You talked about this with Martin Short last week, about being a basket case and being nervous, even though you've done this for years. How do you explain that to someone who listens to you and who's listened to you for years and who thinks you do fine, but I guess you have that doubt, do you?
I think everybody does when they perform, and everybody does, period. That's why only a few people do perform, because they learn how to put that behind them or submerge it or whatever you want to say during the performance. You know, there was a great lawyer in Vancouver years ago called Senator J.W. DeBee Ferris, and he was one of the best lawyers in Canada. And he said till the day he died, he threw up or almost threw up every time he went into court. I don't get nervous going in to do a show particularly. I've done that for a long time. I do get nervous with some guests where I feel that I'm expected to accomplish something. But still in all, you know, as I was saying, I think the other day, if I get 100 emails and 99 of them say what a great guy I am, what a wonderful show I have, and one of them says, Mary, you're an asshole, that's the one that I remember, and that's the one that, you know, sort of strikes at the heart. And I think that's just the way people like that do my job are. We're very insecure people.
One of the things that we've talked about together on email over the last couple of years has been your I've had a passing admiration for Churchill. You have a devout admiration for Churchill. In reading your book, I've noticed that there are similarities between you and he. You're both late bloomers. You both have strong convictions in your political thinking. Were you drawn to him because of that, because of the similarities, or is it just a coincidence that there were similarities between the two of you?
I think it's a coincidence. First of all, you know, Churchill could hardly be called a late bloomer. I mean, he was a famous war correspondent before the Civil War, Boer War, covering the Spanish-American War in 1898. He entered Parliament in 1900, and he was at that time 26 years of age. And he held very substantial portfolios all the time that whatever party he belonged to was in office. I think really what my attraction to Churchill really is the character. The man had character, and he had enormous ability to lead. And I think most importantly at all, he was able to marshal the English language so that it conveyed that leadership to ordinary people. I don't model myself after Churchill. That would be stupid. I know Churchill, never could be. I don't look any bit like him in my career or otherwise. But he was able to talk to the British people in a way they understood. If you listen to what he had to say, he talked during the war. He talked in Shakespearean language because he knew that the public in Britain understood that language. For example, he never talked about bad news. He talked about heavy tidings. He talked the kind of language where people stopped what they were doing and listening and showed enormous leadership. So I think really I don't connect myself in any way to Churchill. I just think that he's one of the world's great leaders, certainly the greatest in the 20th century, and we don't see anything like it today.
Being a contrarian, you write about that in your book. Is that just for the sake of being difficult or being tough, or do you enjoy it? Or
I think it's something that you're born with. Joe, it's just something in your tummy. Either you are a rational, reasonable person that accepts a certain amount of authority and accepts other people's opinions, not just because you tolerate their opinions, but because you think that they may get you further ahead if you go their way rather than your own way. I think it's something you're just either born a contrarian or you're not, and I don't think it's a good thing necessarily. I don't want to leave that impression. I was a disobedient kid, certainly disobedient when it came to thinking the way my parents did, certainly disobedient in the sense of where I went to article and that sort of stuff, and that's something that I say is not necessarily admirable, but I think it's something you're born with, and it's, if you are born with it, it's almost impossible to put behind you.
The book, the last couple of chapters, it seemed to me a sort of, you talk about it as a swan song. The book at the end had a sort of melancholy tone, especially with the last chapter regarding death. Is this book a swan song? Are you winding down your career? Hopefully not.
No, I'm not, Joe. As a matter of fact, I've got I haven't counted them, but I think probably 5,000 or 6,000 words done on the next book. Whether it'll be published or not, of course, remains to be seen. I have 2 years to run on this contract. What happens at the end of that 2 years, again, remains to be seen, but I have no intention of quitting doing essentially what I'm doing, unless, the good Lord tells me otherwise. Or, and I've said this a lot, if somebody that I have trust in comes to me and says, Rafe, I got to tell you, you're just not hitting 350 anymore, you're hitting 220 and you're fumbling ground balls, somebody that I know is telling me what I ought to hear, then I'm out of here.
You're still having fun doing what you do?
This is, without question, the most fun you can have with your clothes on. I enjoy it, and I've got to tell you this, Joe, ever since I've been in this business, matter of fact, most of the work I've done in my life, I've looked forward to Monday, and this is certainly no exception. On Sunday afternoon, I just can't wait for the next day to come.
I'll ask perhaps the most important question. How important is your family unit? And you talk about, I found it fascinating, you have a three-person unit, yourself, your wife Wendy, and your dog. How is that important? How has that helped you in your doing what you do? And
well, I think first of all, it's Wendy that's kept me going since about 1994 or 5. I think if I'd stayed as the way I was, I would have thought of some way to retire and get out of the radio business, because I really needed somebody that could push me to heights and to also really support me and understand. And of course, she really is, as I say in the book, the love of my life, and late in coming, but there she is. But the place we live in, Lions Bay, and the fun we have with Chauncey, who is a chocolate Labrador with all that implies, is just great. And I lead a wonderful life at home and at work, and we get to take, because of the contract I have, a 12 weeks vacation a year, and life is just good. I just wish to hell that it happened to me a lot earlier. You know, the problem with this life is when you're early on in life, 25 or something, nobody ever upgrades your airplane, nobody ever gives you free passes or anything, gives you money or anything like that. When you get old enough that you could probably afford it yourself, all of a sudden all kinds of things come at you free. So I just wish it all happened a little earlier.
Rafe, thanks so much for talking with us today, and congratulations on a fine book.
Thank you very much, Joseph. It's been my pleasure.
Rafe Mayer, catch the Rafe Mayer Show weekday mornings on 600 AM and get the book, Rafe, A Memoir, from Harbor Publishing, $34.95. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plano.